Hello and welcome to the third episode of the MIR podcast, a show dedicated to science education that focuses on topics such as climate change, Earth's energy imbalance, heat adaptation, and climate restoration using surface reflection technology. I'm Peter Dines, a director at MIR, and I will be hosting the podcast on a monthly basis. Dr. Tao will be joining me once again to be our educator on this journey. Dr. Tao is the founder and director of MIR, Mirrors for Earth's Energy Rebalancing, an organization he set up to tackle the greatest threat that humanity has ever faced, namely Earth's energy imbalance. Before setting up MIR, Dr. Tao was running a lab at Harvard's Rowland Institute. MIR is a non-profit organization focusing on surface reflection technology, SRM adaptation and mitigation research, and also climate education, which this podcast is obviously a part of. Over time, we'll be discussing everything to do with climate reality, feasible mitigation, adaptation to the latest scientific papers, and what's going on with the MIR project on an ongoing basis. If you do have any suggested topics that you wish for us to cover, you can tweet us at MIRSRM on X, or alternatively contact us through the website MIR.org. Like I said, the organization is non-profit and we're funded by individuals at this stage, so any donations are always welcome to further our research and humanitarian efforts. You can go to MIR.org/donate. In this episode, Dr. Tao tells us more about the ongoing projects in Africa, what effect a major dust storm had on the mirrors, and we also discuss Freetown's latest heat adaptation plans. I hope you find it interesting, and please remember to like and subscribe to all our media across all our platforms. Okay, so let's get started. Yeah, so how's everybody holding up down there this month? I'm sure it's all been very busy.
It's very busy. It's been quite hectic, this implementation of the sensors and trying to fix the different breakages and some loss to vandalism. But hopefully we will learn the whole community better and maybe get a bit more final engagement, and hopefully can cut down the loss rate per month to a manageable level.
Okay, well, we're going to come on to that actually about the community involvement, whatever, in a little bit. So, but look, we heard about your transition into the climate arena last time, and MIR's decision, to initiate the projects in Africa towards the end of February last year. But what factors did you consider, when selecting Kru Bay, an informal housing settlement? What was the factors for that to be in an ideal location, for the first project?
Coming into Freetown, we didn't really have an idea of where to go. So I spent initial days just walking around the different neighborhoods, taking public transport and running into random people, some of whom became like guides to show me different communities. And after looking at several different informal settlements, it became quite clear that Kru Bay was an ideal place to start, not only because it's well-known in the NGO space as a location that requires a lot of assistance, but also because we were able to see just how tight different constructions were in Kru Bay. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why it's so tight and there's a section that's very uniformly tightly built was because this community suffers from fire repeatedly. Every year, almost, there's some recurrent fire that destroys a section of the community. And since we came here, actually, our experimental site, part of it has been part of a fire disaster. And the cause of that is because people are using electricity not totally according to safety rules. So you invariably get random sparks, especially under high humidity conditions. And that has led to fires breaking out uncontrollably once every year or two. Several years ago, we heard that there was a major one that wiped out a huge section of the community. And that's why a lot of standardized houses were built in that region, which provided a quite ideal location for our experiment because they wanted something that are comparable from one sample to the other and that had roofs that stating from the same time frame, so they have more or less the same albedo due to equal time rusting.
Mm-hmm.
So we identify this patch roughly like a football field, let's say, that had more or less identical roof and the construction styles. And that's the one of the major reasons that we finally decided to be at Krubei rather than at another neighborhood for the first phase experiment, because there are so many variables in these real-world experiments. You really want to eliminate as many variables as possible,
mm-hmm.
to really single out the one that you're looking to find,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
the impact of.
Yeah, no, I was going to say about the fires as well. I think it's quite prone to flooding there as well. But I mean, is there a benefit, I suppose, from cooling the area at all to maybe would prevent fires? But I know there are electrical fires, but if you had an area cooled slightly, would that have any benefit?
I think you would have to do a lot of cooling for that to be a factor. But one potential benefit is in case the fires were caused by somebody just not being careful or fainting, knocking over a stove or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If people are suffering less from heat, they probably have better coordination, better focus, and are generally less clumsy. So it really depends on the mechanism of how the fires are started. Sometimes it's not fully known. I think in the case that happened recently, it's probably because of electrical shorts. Our team actually offered to redo the wiring for all of that community. And we started to do the work on a couple of buildings. Unfortunately, it's quite apparent that as soon as we finish fixing all the wiring and the switchboards for a particular building, people started to dismantle the system and tapping into the wires.
Yeah, you can understand the desperation, I suppose. So you've now moved into the Aberdeen area, and you know you're planning a much bigger community scale project there. Can you tell your reasons why you chose that site as well? And I mean, how effectively, you know, can you communicate to the project, to the people there, you know, from diverse backgrounds, and how can you establish that communication with the community that's really unfamiliar with this type of project?
The primary motivation to go to this Aberdeen Capdon community is due to the topography and size of this community. Crabtown, Aberdeen is roughly 6 hectares in surface area. It's right by the coast. From what I heard, there wasn't such a large community before until the local dump site more or less started to put more and more truckloads of plastic waste into the area and then dump some dirt on it so that you expand it into the sea. It's at the mouth of an estuary. Then people start to build on it, and the community start to expand into the estuary. And the process still goes on as we speak. And some of the planned measurement areas that we have planned out are still being filled with dirt and stone, and eventually they'll be built, and maybe they will become one day part of the measurement. So this area is extremely flat, and buildings are more or less just one single story penthouses. There are also some concrete construction, but the roofs are generally corrugated zinc roofing. So the topography is rather uniform compared to any other urban environment. So this provides a nice environment to do scientific measurement, because you really want to decouple topographical effects from the surface heat transfer effect as much as possible. So that the results would be easier to interpret. And we sought to have a larger community because the Krubei experiments already have given us a good understanding of the response of internal temperatures and surface structural temperatures at single building scale. So the logical extension to that is to multiple buildings, starting from a core at the center, maybe 5 by 5 or 10 by 10 buildings across on each dimension in the first phase, and then gradually expanding. Currently, we're hoping to expand over 3 seasons to about 6 hectares of total lateral area.
Wow! So the whole place is it's built on like a plastic substrate, is it?
mixture of the usual suspects. Glass bottles.
And the, so the second part of that question, was around engaging with the community there to, you know, to communicate what the project is about and how effective you've been at doing that.
You can never do enough outreach and communication within such diverse and big communities. In Western neighborhoods, typically, let's say, middle class, each single family home probably houses one or two families. Maybe if you have 10 people in there, it's already a pretty big family. More typically, I think it's less than 5 people inhabiting a single house with the surrounding yards and garage and driveway and whatnot. In the case of somewhere like Kurube, when you have a single house, it's subdivided into 10 different rooms, sometimes 2-room units, and each of those could host maybe 5 to 10 different people. So within a single structure, you can find 50 people, let's say. And there isn't really any space for, you know, there's no driveway, there's a footpath. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not enough for 2 people to pass through. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine how many people there are in such communities. And Kurube, as an example, have somewhere between 30,000 to maybe 50,000 people. There's no official census data. And if you think about this number, 50,000, that's 1/6 of Iceland. Inside an area that's the size of 10 football fields. So you can imagine how difficult it is to really reach everybody despite your best efforts. So Crabtown is less dense and less crowded than Kurube. And there's some space between the buildings, and the roads are wider. And the reason why we chose that is looking top down, it's more representative of some communities, residential communities you may find elsewhere in the world in terms of the ratio between roof and total area. But still, I think there's still more roofs than a typical residential community in the West or in Europe, let's say. So in such areas, we're still talking about tens of thousands, if not 50,000 people. Like Freetown in general is very diverse. Sierra Leone and Africa in general are very diverse places because in the end, humanity originated from Africa. So you have order 10 times, 100 times more ethnic minorities and tribes per region, per area. And in Freetown, there's on the order of 10 different tribes easily. And within these shantytown communities, there are also on the order of 10 different tribes. And each tribe have their own tribal leader. Some have arrived earlier than others. There's also the traditional local tribe leader, whose family presumably were the first inhabitants of the area, so they have some sort of more official authority, or at least they are well respected. So in order to do anything in the community, it's important that you have engaged with all the tribal leaders as the very basic. So we have spent no less than, say, 3-4 times each day outreach, reaching out to and just walking around asking for the different leaders. And we find that sometimes we feel that we have reached all the leaders, but chances are you haven't. So there's always new leaders who come to us and expressing surprise that we haven't kept them in the loop for what's happening. So that's one thing. And then there's also people of different ages. There's the senior, older men who are in charge, but also there's the up-and-coming young men who have their own power structure. So there's it's a really complex landscape to navigate.
It's quite a dynamic going on there. I just hope there's not as much volcanic activity going on as in Iceland. But So regarding the data that's been collected so far in Freetown, can you elaborate on the most, you know, critical climate and environmental changes that we've noticed, you know, before and after installing the mirror sheets? I mean, is there any significant trends or patterns that you've noticed whilst monitoring the data so far?
Yeah, so now we're back talking about the data collected in phase one of the project in Crewbay, where we monitor what happens at single building scale when you strip the whole roof and replace it with something else, with a different coating, but the same substrate material, which is zinc-coated corrugated iron sheets. One of the main common feature that we observe is that whenever you build these shelters, they tend to increase the temperature, air temperature inside versus the freely flowing air temperature outside. And the effect is minimal at night, but you still observe between 1 and 2 degrees Celsius warmer indoor air temperature compared to outdoor temperature. And during the day, solar radiation really heats up the roofs, and they in turn act as radiators to send heat straight down into the rooms. And that has the effect of baking, essentially, the air inside, thus rising its temperature up by sometimes up to 10 degrees Celsius higher than the outdoor air temperature. So typical air temperature outside at roughly 2-3 meters above ground, I mean, it's difficult to set up at the standard 2 meter height in these heterogeneous communities. So we just put it at roof height slightly over, maybe 2.5 meters. So the typical daily maximum range between 32 and 35 degrees Celsius. It's a lot. In Fahrenheit, it's something like 95 to 100, so in that order. And inside, the temperature can go up to 45 degrees Celsius, between 42 and 45 degrees, which is quite something. And the humidity outside at the 35 degrees remains above 60%, often around 70-80%. So one of the things that I notice, and many other people who come to this part of the world notice, is that you feel really tired. You know, people attribute to different things, like people I talk to. Some say it's because of malaria. Some people say they never recover fully from malaria. But recently, there's a paper coming out in Nature Communications that tried to model the human body's thermal tolerance, taking into account the internal metabolic heat generation. And the authors found that actually humans can take much less heat stress than we previously thought. So the previous gold standard was 35 degrees wet bulb temperature being the lethal temperature. That's the maximum you can tolerate. But the new analysis says, no, the number is actually lower because the body itself is a heat source. So it's not sufficient to consider external heat sources like air temperature, humidity, and solar radiation or IR radiation. You also have to take into account what the individual is doing, because that can increase your basal metabolic rate from a couple hundred watts to up to kilowatts. And that's a lot of heat generated per second, kilowatts. So given that, and we just took a look at our data and tried to map it onto the new finding, the map that maps thermal stress. And during most days in the heat season, like April, March, maybe even extending to May, for senior citizens, they're essentially living in a region of the physiological parameter space that they would be lucky to be alive, because even if they're not moving, their body is accumulating heat in that region, meaning their body is temperature will continue to warm if they're kept in that state, even if they were motionless, stripped naked, and just trying to control their metabolism. Yeah. So, and 30% of the time during the year, that happens. So the conditions are such that people above 65 are at risk of just heat stroke. And after changing to the mirror roof, for example, we're able to more or less move the entire year into a safe zone where the senior citizens can continue to sit around and even walk around their room to have a life. And so they're no longer in the physiological space of risking thermal stroke, even if they were doing nothing. So that's the major, most impactful finding so far that we've noticed.
Wow, that's amazing. And And I was going to ask you about the humidity there as well. Is there any historical data there as well? I mean, has that always been the case?
That's something that we could probably collaborate with the local Met agency to try to see if they have the data extending back a few years.
In terms of humidity and heat waves, is it a massive factor in considering if you were doing this sort of adaptation in areas that where humidity was not dominant as it is in Freetown, would that make a major difference?
I believe if you were operating under a less humid conditions, the impact would be even more dramatic. First of all, the heat capacity that you have to deal with is lower for the air that's without this extra moisture by a little bit. And secondly, people would be able to also engage in evaporative cooling, restore evaporative cooling. These are things to be tested, of course. And when you are in a low humidity environment, generally speaking, efficiency of your reflection might be more effective from a planetary perspective, because there would be less reabsorption by water vapor when the photons and also the long-wave radiation that's going back up to space. We're also considering in the very near future testing passive IR radiative cooling films that's targeting selective thermal emission in the 8 to 13 micron atmospheric transparency window. And for those films to work properly, you really need a rather dry atmosphere. Right. And the tropics might not be the best location for those films. So I think a humid environment is some of the biggest challenging environments to really perform passive cooling adaptation. And that's actually a challenge that I think has inspired some more thinking on our part. And we're currently considering a few new strategies to
deal
with.
Yes, I'm sure we will discuss them at some point as well. I know you have some exciting thoughts on that as well. And that's a great thing about being there, you know, in that sort of environment. So you're experiencing that as well, and so you have to start thinking about how you cope with conditions that maybe we didn't first think of. But in terms of, you know, obviously we're trying to help people adapt to, you know, the heat, is there also a chance that people can learn new skills as well that MIR are bringing to the locality? And, you know, could MIR potentially, you know, have the potential to lift some people out of poverty? I mean, I know there's a lot of disability groups there that maybe are underemployed and things like that. Is that anything in your thinking?
That's exactly some of the things we're really thinking hard about and trying to align our research and R&D process towards. Because the starting premise of the project is, how can we utilize the different challenges, the different problems as opportunities in themselves to solve systematic problems? Because the whole system is interconnected. So if you want to solve one problem, it's impossible to just address a single problem in this day and age. And by the same token, you can often combine different quote, problems as very useful ingredients in your solutions. So examples obviously include the huge amount of discarded waste of all different sorts, which are important primary materials for essentially all the projects we're working on. But also the huge excess of wasted labor that's available in Sierra Leone. I think the people in the age group between 20 and 50, those who have jobs are a small vanishing minority.
Right.
Most people are just trying to scrape by and creating some form of employment for themselves, do street peddling or cook something and just sell their or just to get some produce from larger distributors and then sell them walking along the road into different communities. So there is a lot of wasted human capital here. Granted, the level of technical training remains to be desired, but there are many things that people can be trained to perform, including manual labor with some skills that people can learn over, you know, a few weeks to a few months in some cases. If we say we had the funding somewhere to say a couple million dollars to really purchase the equipment that we need to locally fabricate the mirror sheets rather than having to import them into the country, then we can very easily employ a few hundred to thousands of people, many of whom may already be in the quote waste recycling industry. Yes. Well, the waste recycling here is nothing more than just maybe sorting them and shipping them to the neighboring Guinea that has a bit more funding to do the processing more properly. Yes. And the shipping of these waste, which are not very, takes a lot of space, right? It's not very weight intensive. So it's a lot of waste in truck emissions just to drag them around. So it doesn't really make sense. And the people in Sierra Leone doing the waste picking and sorting, they are not earning a livable wage. They get maybe just two bowls of rice, three with some sauce for a day of toiling in the docks. Wow. And that doesn't make sense. So if we just get a couple million investments, we can immediately make a huge difference to the lives of these people. So instead of just doing that step, and most profit goes to business people in Guinea, at least the Sierra Leoneans would be able to get the actual benefit of the waste recycling process. Right. And we're also, you know, because of the limitation in local infrastructure, we have been forced to think about how and whether it's possible to use low-tech techniques, not relying on factory-level waste sorting, reprocessing, remelting, injection molding, etc., but rather in a more like atelier craftsman style workshop, whether we can transform the waste into useful things. And so far, we've been successful at making many useful everyday objects from them. For example, brooms. We can use plastic to make waste baskets. We can make purses out of the water bottles. We can make vases. Also, we have recently learned how to do an entire new type of furniture making using only plastic bottle derived cordage as the fastener, using fast growing wood from like young trees, seedlings that are very easily replenished in plantations as the compressive structure material for these furnitures, and using the cordage to provide the tension elements and the joinery elements. So, and we're currently working on a bench swing with a mirror shade that could be deployed in public spaces based on plastic bottles and a few of these dowels that's between 1 and 2 inches in diameter and up to maybe 3 meters in length.
Well, we'll see.
And the whole processing could be done with nothing more than, you know, $100 worth of tools.
Yes.
So that's very easily scalable, even in a very much resource-deprived environment.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's lots of innovation going on, and more innovation that could be had. And obviously, our project is, you know, we're really focused on, obviously, you know, adaptation and mitigation, but we're also a humanitarian project. And, you know, to give people employment, a better economic future is also you know, really, really important. So listen, I want to ask you about, there was this Harmattan dust storm that hit the city recently. And I'm curious about its impact on the sheeting. You know, did the storm decrease the effectiveness of the sheeting? And you know, can this material be cleaned well enough to raise the albedo back to make it effective again?
Yeah, so this year has been like a remarkably more dusty than the last. I don't remember seeing this level of surface contamination like last year. So indeed, like the mirror roofs that we implemented last April, right now if you look at them, they're just maybe half the reflectivity or even a bit less than compared to when they were newly installed. And we took a brief look at the surface. We were not doing any cleaning at this moment because it's a controlled experiment. And we don't want to do any cleaning without a proper experimental protocol to test, say, the efficacy of different cleaning methods. But if you touch the small section with your finger, the dirt very easily comes off. So the dust are rather a large grain. Mm. So it's basically like desert sand. You can really tell from the color and just the texture. It's not urban grime. Mm-hmm. That's usually soot black and more tar-like. Yes. It's really a very loose sand. So I think they would be pretty amenable to cleaning, but of course the exact efficacy that remains to be rigorously tested, because we're still waiting for the water pumps that we will be using in the cleaning experiment. So we'll be testing a few different methods side by side, including just running water, without any falling speed. And we can also throw the water up high to simulate rainfall cleaning. We can also just use a broom to sweep it up, or use some sort of a blower, liquid waterless, because that water is, a very valuable resource you can do without water. Yeah, and that's a plus. Yeah.
And I'm assuming it will wash off in the rainy season as well. Anyway, it would.
Yeah, we will certainly reserve some of the buildings for a natural to observe their behavior under natural cleaning agents.
And I'm assuming you'll be inventing a solar blower at some point as well. So, that would come in useful.
Yes.
Okay, so listen, my last question, because we've gone for 35 minutes so far, my last question is just about, you attended that heat adaptation workshop in the council with the chief heat officers, which we should call them cooling officers really, but Eugenia Carbo, a couple of days ago. Can you just elaborate on what was discussed there and what direction the city council are moving in terms of like how to protect the local people? What's their thoughts on it, and how was your involvement?
Yeah, so together we have come up with a quite ambitious plan that consists of four different parts. So part one is obviously to educate the people about the impact of heat, and to be able to do so, we do need to gather more data, because there is a really paucity of data, including a cause of death, for example, in the Freetown context. So we don't know if excess deaths that's observed in the past are heat related, because there's just simply no funding or past research to make any causal attributions. So we do not, we cannot really be sure that the recommendations we'll be sharing are really Freetown specific, but the first step is obviously just to do the outreach using based on results from other studies from other locations, assuming, of course, human beings are more or less the same due to the short time spent outside of our common niche where we evolved, where ancestry evolved in Ethiopia. So there is likely limited thermal adaptation, even though there are some evidence. But generally, evidence is also that on the high temperature end, the range of adaptability is more compressed compared to over the lower temperature ends. So that's the first part, to educate the population of Freetown, especially those living in low-income communities, which we hypothesize to be subject to more heat stress based on, for example, our measurement of Kube, where daily highs well over 40 degrees Celsius are routinely observed. I don't think any middle-income communities, even in Freetown, routinely experiences that. So I think that's a safe assumption. It's correct that the council and everybody, we agree that targeting informal settlements, low-income communities, make them a priority for education is the good approach. Mm-hmm. So that's target number one. Target number two is really to gain a full scientific understanding of the problem of heat within the peninsula of Freetown. The methodology will be the same wherever you are doing experiments around the world. And it more or less consists of, in my opinion, three different pieces. Of course, I wasn't in charge of directing the development of the procedure during the during the event, but I will be for sure part of the group editing the final recommendation and final plan. So the three parts are, first, you do need objective physical measurements of the microenvironmental parameters that include air temperature, humidity, radiation levels, et cetera, right? The instrumental measurements, you have to have that at high spatial resolution, for one. It has to be extensive in area coverage as a second requirement, and it has to extend over sufficient length of time. And for all intents and purposes, we decide that 1 year continuous measurement is what's really needed to have a very basic understanding of the background conditions. And possibly we could even extend the initial diagnostic measurements to 2 or 3 years to get some sense of the natural interannual variability. So that's the measurement part. And in the measurement part, we need we obviously cannot install a sensor into everybody's homes and everybody's work locations. So there would be some reduction needed to classify, you know, the different habitats, the different lodging into different types, and just have representative types measured, maybe 10 in each community. So over all in Freetown, anywhere between a few hundred to maybe maximum 1,000 sensors around the whole town in these microenvironments. So that's to cover stationary, moderately high spatial resolution measurements that extends over time. But then how do you really make the link between these location-specific measurement to the overall, say, top-down observed heat map of Freetown? Then, so the goal now is to put sensors onto a team of mobile team of motorcycle riders. So motorcycle is one of the main local transportation system. And the team of, say, 20 different motorcycles would be circling the city three times a day, 365 days a year, in order to have a better spatial coverage of the temperature variations. Albeit it will be like a temperature measured on the road, which will for sure be different from temperature you measure off the road in people's compounds and residential areas. But perhaps there might be some larger scale spatial correlation that we can map one to the other. And that we don't know, but it's one of the hypotheses to be tested. And at each neighborhood, we would also install a weather station to provide outdoor temperature measurements. So the combination of the three type of data sets, the mobile motorcycle-based, the weather station, air temperature-based, and also micro-environmental temperature sets together, they may enable developing a model to map between, say, the weather station data to the fine scale measurements. If that's possible, then in principle, we do not need to continue the microscopic, you know, microenvironmental measurements all the time into the future if the goal is to predict what the heat stress will be at those locations. As long as we know for that day and the time what the macroscopic environmental parameters are, what are the downwelling solar radiation and long wave radiation, what's the wind speed, what's the humidity, then hopefully we'll be able to use those as model parameters to predict what happens at the finer scale. And that would enable developing a alarm system, heat alarm system, and which is one of the goals. So I talked about like the scientific measurement, but then there's also the more humanistic subjective interview type of survey instruments to be conducted to really try to start to understand that any correlation between what you measure with your instruments and what people report for their health status, for their moods, for their psychological health, and for their personal perception of heat comfort, whether it's too cold or too warm. And so those two will be analyzed together as well. And finally, I think it would be great if there could be a medical team that teams up to really try to understand diagnosable medical conditions and events like heart attacks and heat strokes, and how that maps onto the microscopic microenvironments. Yes. So I think these three types of studies, the medical one, medical record keeping, the survey questions, and also the physical instrumentation-based studies should together yield a pretty good picture for the stable T stress. The third goal would be to identify problem areas and actually doing the interventions like the one we're doing.
All right, okay. Sheets.
So that's the helping
right,
people.
Right, well, that's yeah. Hopefully that's one of the most important parts. There's a lot going on there. But sounds like excellent research, and we can't wait to see results from that.
Okay, once again, we are out of time for this episode. I want to thank Dr. Tao for his time and his fascinating information in this third podcast. We'll be back again next month looking at other aspects of the projects with a focus on water adaptation. Make sure you look out for that conversation. Thanks to anyone who's tuned into the live stream and for those listening to the recording. We hope you find the conversation useful and enlightening. Just a reminder, you can follow our developments at our website, meer.org, that's meer.org, or follow our ex-Twitter feed at meersrm. And once again, MIR is a non-profit, and we really appreciate any donations you can make towards our ongoing research and humanitarian efforts. To do so, go to meer.org/donate. Thanks again for listening.